Are there any questions? Who is Rembrandt? We're going to get to it. That's the biggie. We're gonna get to that. And you know it, John Gere. Shame on you. Any other questions? It may sound strange to begin a thing by asking questions, because usually there are questions at the end. Or, when we talk about art, the thing is so threatening that nobody has any questions at all. And particularly when you start talking about people like Rembrandt. Rembrandt is a person who has had such good PR. Like most artists, he probably wishes he had had such good PR while he was alive. could use all the help we can get while we're living, but it seems like after we die, it all comes round, and people benefit from what we have done while we're alive. I recently sold a painting to the Chase Manhattan Bank in New York, which is probably the world's largest collector of art, and you have to suspicion why a bank wants one of your paintings. And I feel that there is somehow hovering over my house this great vulture called the Chase Manhattan Bank, waiting for me to die so that my painting increases. It's like buying stock. You know, as soon as I'm dead, that all goes up. So all you folks, get me while I'm alive, because I'm cheap now. After I'm dead, you won't be able to afford me. I won't be able to afford me. Nobody will be able to afford me. Yeah. Do I do? Well, it's all crazy. That doesn't say anything. Well, I do Jesus art. Now, that's not like I go around, you know, like this all the time, but I think probably the episode that explains best what I do is when I was in the middle of my master's degree program at Indiana University, and the professor came into my studio while I was working and said, "Jesus Christ, not another Jesus Christ." That's what I do. And I do it in all forms. And most of the forms that they are in now are architectural. My favorite thing to do is glass. I love glass. And I do glass all over the world. We're working on glass projects in Yugoslavia, under the water, off the coast of France, monasteries in Canada and Jerusalem, but mostly Minnesota, which needs all the color it can get. So I'm putting all kinds of color into Minnesota and North and South Dakota, which needs it even more than Minnesota, and doing some things in California and Connecticut and Guatemala and just all over. Oh, seven, no, I don't think that Norman would have allowed me to do that, no. Norman is my bishop, and I mean, you gotta have, bishops have to have some say, and I think before I would do a Seventh-day Adventist church, I would check with my bishop to see if it was okay. I don't think he'd allow me to do, I wouldn't know what to do for a Seventh-day Adventist church. I am going to show you some things today that will illustrate the fact that there is a tremendous difference, and that if you are of a mind to do a thing in a certain way, your things will not be tolerated by people of even slightly different persuasions. Rembrandt was such a critter, and I think it's going to be interesting because you know, we talked about Yoder the other night, and I think our biggest problem with John explaining Yoder to us was when he got to the crucifixion. I had a horrible time between crucifixions and resurrections, and where you put the, you know, it was almost like Yoder was putting the emphasis on the wrong syllable, and I got really kind of a little uptight, because I think I think I'm a resurrection person, maybe. And then I got to prepare for Rembrandt and find a Descent from the Cross by Rembrandt next to a Descent from the Cross by Rubens. Now, Rubens was living at the same time and was very Roman Catholic. Rembrandt starts out as a Calvinist, but is not able to take all the rules and regulations, being a crazy fellow. And he switches over to what of all things? Just before he does this Descent from the Cross, he becomes Mennonite. Whew! And a Mennonite descent from the cross is not a Roman Catholic descent from the cross. They are two different ideas where you put the glory. And I studied that Descent from the Cross by Rembrandt and decided that I got to get into crucifixion a little bit more. And maybe under the impetus of Yoder and Schramm and Rembrandt together, which is an unlikely triumvirate if I ever heard. But it's doing things on me at any rate. It's nifty. Okay, any other things? I'm doing things for synagogues, yeah? I'm doing things for synagogues who are some of my favorite clients are Jewish folk. They seem to be a little bit freer in their acceptance of non-representational things. They still have that not making graven images command deep-seated. And I think a lot of my glass is becoming not illustration sort of thing, but mood and feeling in color. And Jewish people seem up for it, certainly much more than Protestant, generally Protestant people do. And that's kind of fun, going back and forth there. I'm not putting down Seventh-day Adventists. I just don't think I know enough about them to do something worthy of their arenas, you know. I would feel the same way doing glass in a Pentecostal place, although I don't think it'll ever... I don't think I'll ever have to worry about it. Pentecostal places are the dullest places you have ever seen in your life. They're just really, really bad news for us artists. I mean, it's like say something in Southern Baptist. I got no images that come to mind, you know. You know how you can go through a town and say, that's got to be this kind of church, that's got to be that kind of church. And you know, there are certain styles that are that is an Episcopal church if I ever saw one, you know. Or that is a Presbyterian, that is a Lutheran church. Usually it's probably far out. If it isn't far out, because it's a little... The town has a German name, and it's the only church in town. Then you know. You know the play Our Town? They had the big Protestant church, and the Roman Catholic church was on the other side of the railroad tracks amongst all of the Polish and Irish people. Who were the laborers, the bankers and the printers? You know, they all went to the Protestant church. And there are looks that accompany the varieties of people that build worship spaces. We ought to spend some time. I'd like to do that sometime. Just talk about contemporary churches and church architecture and see how we, do something like that sometime. I got thousands of slides. Okay, Rembrandt. Rembrandt is very, very difficult to talk about, and he's difficult for a couple of reasons. First, we don't treat him like a human being, and that's why I want you to ask questions. In fact, in the middle, you know, it's going to get dark, and so I won't be, you know, don't raise your hand. Just say, Rich, and I'll say, yeah, and you say, you just lost me on that last statement. Would you kind of clarify that? Just go ahead and do that, because I won't be able to see. I usually talk in class to the bridges of people's noses, and then I can tell whether what I'm saying is making any sense or not. Most of you don't want to ask questions, but this little business right here just goes crazy when something is wrong. That's why, and I realize, that's why I got glasses that have that little hole in there. That's, you know, that's so the bridge can communicate to people when I'm afraid to ask questions. But seriously, seriously, you know, it's all of this. It's like a little walnut, you know, when you open up a walnut, and it's almost like looking at brains, huh? Isn't it? Well, this is almost like looking at brains when you're a lecturer or when you have something, you know, when you analyze visual things all the time. Now you people are getting very self-conscious, aren't you? We took off the glasses in the back so I can tell what you're thinking. You cleaned yours. I don't want them clean. My gosh. I just, you know, just move this stuff and I'll say it a different way and maybe that'll help clarify things. But Rembrandt is so much of a deity, is so much of the numero uno. I mean, he has got to be in the top five of everybody's top five. I mean, the first name that comes to mind, Michelangelo, Rembrandt, probably can't think of any more, huh? And so he's in the top two. He may be the top one. For all we know, he's the only one you can think about. So Kemmerer, don't say anything too negative about Rembrandt because he can do no wrong. Ah, he did a lot of silly, silly business. And he had a problem. He had a problem in his developmental stage, both with his personality and with his art. And it's exciting to talk about it and to see in his work how these things get worked out and how the problem is illustrated by his work. A big question that gets asked all the time is an artist born, you know, are you born artists? I think being, you know, what, sprung, full-blown from the womb with a paintbrush in your hand, which would smart. I can't even, that, scratch that symbolism. That's not, really not fair to motherhood. You don't talk about that with things, with people outside of art. You don't say that man is a born electrician, you know, or that Gertrude was a born flower arranger. I think that comes from practice, and I think maybe that Van Gogh, who tried all of these different things in his life. He was a paint salesman in London. Can you imagine Vincent Van Gogh in London? Boy, talk about culture shock. He did all kinds of weird vocational things all of his life and didn't do his first painting until he was 32. Can you call that guy a born painter? I don't think so. I think people, when they get into art for a whole lot of reasons that they learn about when they're children in their developmental years, which I know beans about, so I'm not going to talk about it. I have no credentials for that. It just seems to me that there is development that decides whether or not art is a thing for you or not. And I don't see, oh, who's the finest artist living today? Some of you will probably say Andrew Wyeth. I don't like Andrew Wyeth, but that's my own personal hang-up. But this guy was not a... You want to look at an early Andrew Wyeth? Man, he had a lot to learn. And when I look at the stuff that I submitted for entry into Washington University in St. Louis, where I went to undergrad school, it's embarrassing. Absolutely embarrassing. I was married in front of my first painting, which was a frightening thing. I had a commission. My first church commission was for a church in Maplewood, Missouri. It was a great altar painting, $1,400. I said, I'll take it. Whoa, $1,400 for a junior in college to do a painting? Oh, wow, was that fantastic. So I did the painting. I thought it was the great, you know, the great theological statement of all time. I graduated, and I freelanced for a year. I went into the Army for 2 years. 4 years later, I come back with my bride, and we stand in front of that painting and that altar and get married. Liz's dad was one of the pastors, and my dad was another one of the pastors, and we got double knotted. I mean, this thing is destined to go on through eternity. There's no way we can get out of it. But by golly, at the time, both of those poor pastors were standing up there very worried about me and my whole attitude, because I spent virtually the whole ceremony shaking my head back and forth. I wasn't trying to get out of the wedding. I was looking at that really grotesque painting over the altar. Oh, Jesus. And all our wedding pictures, of course, got this thing in back of it, you know. So I don't look at the, I don't want to look at them anyway, but with that thing in the back, it makes them even worse. Really bad. I mean, I was not a born painter. I sure hope that now I know some things that I wouldn't be caught, you know, dead repeating. So it's a learning thing. And Rembrandt shows us that as he develops, he learns. And that's exciting. I think another thing he shows us is that artists are not ahead of their time. Oh, if I could just convince you right now that the role of the artist is not to sort of be out in the vanguard, you know, and drag the rest of folks with them. And that's why, you know, that when we talk about art, we make all of us seem so stupid. And the way we explain our stupidity is by saying, that guy is ahead of his time. And therefore, we don't have to understand because we are in our time. Well, that's not true. The artist is in the middle of his time. And everybody else is behind. Oh, is that frightening? That's a little scary. But the truth. The role of the artist is actually to depict the time that he is in, or she. More she's now, which is good and scary, because they are coming in on our turf fearlessly. And boy, there is nothing quite so scary as a fearless she. Well, at any rate, this is so important that when you look at an artist, you are looking at the time. If you want to know something about Egypt, you don't read the writings too much because, boy, what the pharaohs said about themselves, half of that is not to be believed. But you can look at the paintings and you can look at the sculpture and you can look at the architecture and you will know exactly what was going on, how the lives were lived. And you can look at Rembrandt and you can understand pretty much what was going on in Rembrandt and in his time. And it was a rugged, rugged time. The Spaniards had just moved out. And the Protestants and the Catholics divided up the territory in Holland and Belgium, just split it up. And it was a kind of a gruesome time. I mean, these people had just gone through a kind of an Inquisition sort of thing, which was devastating, really ugly. I mean, for adultery, a man would be hung. Okay, a woman would not be hung for adultery for the same crime, because in hanging there, she would tempt others to look up her dress. And so she would be buried alive. Icky pooey. I mean, it was really a rugged, rugged time. And now Spain has left the North Country and has left it to Dutch folk. I don't know how many of you have any Dutch background, but you never saw such busy bees in all your life. These people are industrious, they have minds like computers, they are navigators and sailors, they are great people. And they've got a work ethic which puts Holden Village to shame. So, Holland gets its act together and becomes very commercial. And rises a group of people which used to be lowly under the Spaniards and now have become burghers, a great mass of wealthy middle-class folk. And there's your clientele. Those are the people who buy art. Not the churches. And why not the churches? Because the churches, at least Rembrandt's part of the population, are Calvinist. And I don't know if you know about what the Calvinist response is to art, but it ain't pleasant. It's whitewash, that's what it is. Just paint the whole inside of the building white, make the windows either clear or with a little yellowish tint to it, and have done with it, and put a big pulpit and a little table and just talk. That's it. Don't look, talk and listen. That's the emphasis. And along comes Rembrandt, and he's a painter. He's got no royalty to paint for. They're moved back to Spain. He's got no church to paint for. He is Protestant. So who does he paint for? He paints for who all the other people are painting for, the middle class. Now, what does the middle class want? The middle class in Holland wanted exactly what the middle class from all time wants. Wants what we want. We're sort of middle class folks. And if one of you were to come right up now and say, Rich, I'd like you to do something for Over the Mantle. What would you want? Well, how about a picture of Holden Village? I mean, you can live with that, huh? You know, the mountain scene, little village nestled in the valley. Or maybe a seascape. Or a landscape. Or what we call genre. Scenes of everyday life. Maybe a scene from with something humorous, like a lady spilling eggs all over the kitchen floor, so that when you walk through the house, you can say, ho, 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 ain't life wonderful? And it's all peaceful, and there are no waves, except on your seascape. Nobody is making great big heavy statements so that as you pass your mantle, you put your hand up and you say, oh, God be praised. I wonder what all of this means. Nothing like that at all. Nothing heavy. Everything light. And, of course, you have to demonstrate craft. It has to be excellent craft. Slick as a board. Because they're paying good money for artists' work. They don't want things thrown up there. And especially if you're Dutch. Because Dutch people probably as much, if not more, than anybody on the face of the earth admire excellent craftsmanship. So it's got to be smooth. It's got to be very slick. And along comes Rembrandt into this whole idea. He is not Catholic. And he is working for commercial middle-class Holland. All right, let's take a look. One of the first paintings we have on record of Rembrandt is a religious painting. Now that's crazy. That's why I call him one of my crazy friends. He has ignored the market. Completely ignored anybody. Who's going to buy this? A little tiny painting. It's about a foot tall. Rembrandt illustrates already that, first of all, he is single-minded, that he will paint what he jolly well pleases. And what Rembrandt jolly well pleases is religious subject matter. Rembrandt, in his heart of hearts, is a very, very spiritual being. And a great majority of his work has religious theme to it. Now, Rembrandt is able to paint almost any subject, and that sets him also apart from the rest of his colleagues. Some of these guys were painting landscapes. Some of them were painting still lives. Some of them were painting portraits. Rembrandt was able to go from one subject to the other and paint them all. Altogether in his life, Rembrandt painted 640 paintings, which is not really a great deal. He was a slow worker. He was a very slow worker, and the reason that he came out with that many pieces of work is that he painted all the time. There was almost no time at which he was not doing some painting. In addition to that, he also did about 1,200 prints and 2,000 drawings, which are on record. We can look at early Rembrandts, like you have on the on your right, for a couple of different ideas. But the first idea we have to look at is light. Rembrandt is essentially about light. And he has two different lights operating simultaneously. One comes from around the figure, and one comes from inside the figure. Now, if we look back at that first subject, the light is really coming from around. This is an illustration of the of that little episode at Emmaus where Christ makes himself known after the resurrection. And these two disciples are flabbergasted. One falls back off of his stool. One's eyes are just blazing because he finally realizes as Christ disappears from the midst of them and turns almost into a shadow that he has been talking all along to the fellow that was crucified just prior to this. But the light now comes from around these figures, and the figures really cast shadow. They cast shadow, but they also cast light. In this one, which is the presentation in the temple, and once again, Rembrandt insists on doing religious subject matter, someone had said about Rembrandt that he was an icon painter in an iconoclastic age. I think that pretty well does it. That pretty well summarizes Rembrandt. Here, he has managed to make architecture one of the dominant themes, and Rembrandt never did paintings of architecture after this. Architecture for Rembrandt was not worthy. In fact, Rembrandt's entire output, no matter what the subject, was intent upon trying to explain the relationship of God to our present world. That summarizes Rembrandt. And of course, that means that what he was painting was a mystery. He was trying to explain a mystery. I keep thinking when I look at Rembrandt paintings of St. Paul, "I present to you a mystery." And Rembrandt was doing the same thing in images. Rembrandt came from lowly background. His father was a miller. He ran a mill and was not a brilliant man. In fact, Rembrandt seems to paint him from time to time as a bit of a dolt, not too intelligent at all. This is a common, ordinary person, a laborer, and Rembrandt did this early portrait of his father. But Rembrandt was, he must have drove people crazy, very much like Vincent. They're both Dutchmen, remember, and don't these look like early Van Goghs, those of you that saw Vincent earlier this week? That very dark brown stuff and the light and the laborer thing. That's typically Dutch. But Rembrandt liked to bring people into his house and dress them up. Rembrandt must have had a couple of huge boxes or trunks full of costumes. These are both paintings of his father, both of these. Now the painting on the right is more typically the kind of costume that he would have worn. That's his father. Can you imagine this poor miller coming over to his son's house of an evening, and Rembrandt says, "Hey, Dad, put on the turban. I'd like to do your portrait." And this poor man gets all gussied up in a like an Oriental potentate, There's a miller underneath all of that finery. That's a marvelous painting. And once again, the painting is about light. And already early on, we're talking about Rembrandt at 26 years old. And he's beginning to get quite a reputation. And you can see this light from around the image as well as light from within the image. He's beginning to think of two different kinds of light. Look at this painting on the... There's his father again on the right. He painted a lot of portraits of his father up to the time he died, and every one of them is quite different. Some are terribly grand, and some of them are really kind of almost caricatures. But Rembrandt developed a style of portraiture that made him very popular. Rembrandt was popular in his own time. He got top dollar, more money for a portrait than any other artist in all of Holland. He had very good press. The secretary to the ruler, to the ruling folk in Holland, wrote great things about Rembrandt and was responsible for getting him some very good commissions. But this is a typical style for Rembrandt. The figure on your left, very very typical. It shows a portrait. A visual depiction, not the interior kind of portraits of souls that Rembrandt is most familiar to us with. Excuse me. Well, he starts painting around 1630, and he's about 24 or 5 at that time. And he paints for about 30 years. I think he dies in 1665, if I'm not mistaken. That's a self-portrait over on the left. I didn't need to say that. Rembrandt did about 45 self-portraits, and it would be very interesting to just take all of the photographs of his self-portraits from beginning to end and see how he looked at himself. Because as times got very, very hard, and Rembrandt suffered miserably in his life, he went through hells during his lifetime, to see these kinds of incidents and concerns depicted in his face, in his self-portraits, is really wonderful. You could probably tell much more about that than about anything anybody might have written about him. Rembrandt did not write, as contrasted with Van Gogh. He wrote only 7 letters that we have documented, and all of those 7 are about business. And Rembrandt hated business. He must have really been an artist. All artists hate business. This is Rembrandt's sister on your right. And even though it's a very straightforward painting, I think we're able to see already his concern in his early period for reflected things. Rembrandt's early period shows us an awful lot of interest in, I think that's why he dressed up people, because he liked to see light bouncing off of different objects. And here light is bouncing off marvelously off of that bodice. The beautiful clothes that she's wearing. She is a miller's daughter, but she is not wearing miller's daughter's clothes. She's wearing something out of Rembrandt's trunk. This is Saskia. Rembrandt painted Saskia just scads of times. He married her. Rembrandt moved into a fellow's house, an art dealer, and there he met the daughter of the landlord, and the landlord was very wealthy. Saskia had an excellent dowry. In fact, it was too excellent for Rembrandt's own good. and got Rembrandt into considerable trouble, because once he married Saskia, he moved up into society. And Rembrandt was a painter of the common person. And I have a hunch that society, high society, excellent living, was just not the kind of life that Rembrandt needed for his own good. For the development of his painting, it was excellent for us all. I mean, it's kind of like Beethoven, who suffered with that deafness and interior torments, and we say, boy, the poor man, and yet it's out of that suffering that so much of his great music came. It's the same with Rembrandt. There's another self-portrait on your right. It would be nice if you could remember those when I show you the last self-portrait that he did, because it's wonderful. Here he is kind of angry. Seems kind of almost daring you to react. This man, Rembrandt, had an ego, had a tremendous ego. That's another thing that artists have to have. Great egos, in order to put up with not only the responses of people, but to even risk sharing what it is they feel in their heart of hearts, and to say, what I have, what I feel, is worthy to share with you. That requires tremendous ego. But Rembrandt's ego was fed by his popularity, and he was getting, as I say, tremendous commissions at this time. It was the companies, like fraternities and guilds, that would commission the finest work, much more than the churches. And Rembrandt got all of the great commissions, and they would take the form of like a composite portrait. It was a very popular thing, these group portraits, and most of them look like fraternity photographs you see in college yearbooks. They are totally uninspiring, and it's all of them lined up in a row, or one row behind the other. And Rembrandt immediately, right from the beginning, changed the whole style of group portraiture and decided to put the groups into the settings that were most appropriate to their groupness, the reason why they were groups. This is a company of doctors, and the doctors, instead of having their portraits painted all looking out at the portraitist, are all instead undergoing an anatomy lesson. Now, these are all doctors. It may seem a little strange to us to see all these perfectly grown men taking lessons in anatomy, but there they are, and the professor is... The only difference between the doctor and the professor is that the professor wears a hat. And I think that's kind of neat. I'd like to lecture with a hat on at the university. Now the only difference between me and the students is that I'm the only one standing up. That's the only way you can tell the professor from the student. But here they all seem to be standing and milling about, trying to find, you know, the subject of the professor's lecture. But they are not all paying attention. Not all at all. Some are looking out. The fellow at the top is looking out. This fellow over here is looking out at the viewer. And Rembrandt constantly does this. It's a Baroque idea, and that is to involve the person who is looking into the space of the picture itself, or into the idea, by giving us eye contact with one of his people. That puts us into a kind of psychological as well as physiological relationship to the painting. You see, the fellow behind the doctor over there has made a little list. And on the list are all the names of the students of this particular fraternity. And that's how we know that this is kind of a document representing this group at this particular time. He did a number of anatomy lessons, and this is another one over on the other side. They're really all rather gruesome. Rembrandt enjoyed doing flayed skin, which is, I don't know how you'd want to analyze that if you were a psychoanalyst, but one of his great paintings, I wish I had a slide of it, is of a side of beef hanging on a hook. Obviously, there were no markets for such paintings. You can imagine hanging that over your mantelpiece. But he loved the idea of flesh. Rembrandt never painted high-blown schemes of things. Out of all the religious stuff that he painted, one is an ascension, which is going to have to be pretty abstract, but he would never paint something like the Trinity or the Flood, the Deluge. He would never paint something that had to be done on a grand, grand scale. Rembrandt was just incapable of doing that. That was left to people like Rubens and the Baroque Catholics to paint. Rembrandt's entire output of religious subject matter, and in fact I think his entire output period, concentrates very much on simple, rather lowly, and very non-abstract ideas. And here is a good example. This is the philosopher over here on your right, and there's a lady tending the fire. The ladies worked hard in Holland. That's so that the men folk could spend their time thinking. I like that. They would spend more time just thinking, worrying about the important subjects. And Rembrandt symbolizes that whole philosophical undertaking by putting that spiral staircase. That's about as symbolic as Rembrandt ever gets. Oh, I think there was another. Yeah, that's a close-up of that. Just beautiful light. That light coming from outdoors. It's just gorgeous. Here's another portrait of an old philosopher that he did. And we're starting to gradually move away from pure realism, and he's starting to paint thicker in a less, once again, he's going to start losing his clients anymore. Any of the clients that he's got left, he's going to lose if his paint gets any thicker than this, because the Dutch folks don't want gloppy paint. It's an incredible portrait. I love this thing on the on your right. Oh, that's a funny painting. That is a funny painting. This is, I don't know very much about Greek mythology. I should know more because it keeps cropping up in art all the time. And to give you an idea of how poorly Rembrandt handled these rather abstract ideas, this is Andromeda. Now, the story of Andromeda is pretty complicated. She gets tied up by a dragon, and I think Perseus comes to rescue Andromeda. Well, Rembrandt does not do dragons. Dragons are the antithesis of Rembrandt. I don't think he could do a snake with wings on it. And in fact, he couldn't even do Perseus, because Perseus, I think, had wings on his feet or something like that. And at any rate, he was an abstract character too. So what we have here is a poor little middle-class Dutch girl caught in a predicament. That's all. It's not Greek mythology at all. I don't want to start talking about ladies' bodies. But folks, this is not a classical lady's body. This is a little Dutch girl, or a housefrau, or something. She's a little pot-bellied. She's not very pretty. I mean, can you imagine the Venus de Milo with a face like that? With her hair pulled back? Greek goddesses have hair that flows and covers parts of their... She looks like an egg on top there. And I think probably Perseus doesn't get into the picture here because Perseus probably would have just left her hanging there. Wouldn't have bothered fighting a dragon for this poor girl because she's really not all that attractive. Nor is this gal. This is Sophonisba. A Sophonisba is a great lady in Greek history. She was married to a Carthaginian general, and she was taken captive by an African guy, and she sort of skips her out on her husband and falls in love with the guy who captures her, sort of a Patty Hearst thing, and she marries this African general. Well, that's a no-no. And when the African general is defeated, he is forced to commit suicide, and the African general says to her husband, to his wife, Sophonisba, since I have to die and you love me so much, it would only be fair if you died too. That people talked funny in those days. And so Sophonisba says, yeah, I really do love you an awful lot, and so I think I will die with you. And she takes the cup of poison and dies rather happily. So this is a picture of her about to receive the cup. But Sophonisba in history is kind of like Aida. In Rembrandt, she's pregnant and she is a Dutch housefrau. I love her chins. Sophonisba did not have that many chins. But it is a beautiful painting. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, he can, yeah, yeah. I don't know whether it's an impossible hand, but it sure is crumpled up. I guess it has more to do with the model than anything else, but it wouldn't be symbolic because that isn't Rembrandt's thing. She's crossing her fingers. Maybe she's hoping it's Pepsi-Cola, or I really don't know. I haven't analyzed. Her other hand is perfectly normal, so there may be something in the gesture that tells us something. Maybe it's preparation for death. Maybe there is something in that is slightly symbolic. But we want to look at this and say Rembrandt paints really cruddy ladies. And then we look at this. Whew. This is really marvelous. This is Danae. She is also mythological. This is also Rembrandt's wife. And she is a Shainstababe. I mean, she is a very handsome lady. Now there's all kinds of mythology in here too, and Rembrandt has to fudge. There was in all of this a lover that came creeping, and there is also a shower of gold, and Rembrandt was not able to paint that shower of gold. In fact, he didn't do too well even with a golden Cupid up there in the upper right-hand corner. Seems like it's sort of pasted on from an old-fashioned Valentine. For Rembrandt, the shower of gold was light, and that light comes pouring in and bounces off of a couple of little objects like this little ewer down in the lower left-hand corner. The shoes are under the bed, and she is just really lovely. Now we are getting into Rembrandt probably at his peak, at least as far as learning what the rest of his life was going to be about. This is a little painting about a foot tall, and it's Rest on the Flight into Egypt. There is light there. It could be a lantern, it could be a candle, but it is not enough, certainly, to light this whole thing. That is much more mysterious. So Rembrandt is talking about the incarnation. And maybe this is the way we saw the baby Jesus in real life, as an event which was very human, but at the same time very special. When you go to Jerusalem, you have a hard time believing that Jesus could have made any impact there at all. Maybe there was something special about the way he looked. You'd like to think that it was primarily in the things he said that attracted people to him. But for Rembrandt, the only way to describe that specialness was with this light. That whole painting is made out of light. Now, Rembrandt was able to do some lofty things, and he gets rather Baroque in this ascension. This is a painting that was commissioned by some nobility. And it's a fine painting, but people don't like it because it just isn't typical Rembrandt. Rembrandt should keep his stuff down on the level of people. But he risked. Rembrandt was a great risker. He was always walking the edge of things that he himself was able to do and things that he thought other people were going to accept. Never made too much of his decisions based on what was possible and what was acceptable, but more on the basis of what needed to be done and how he felt. Oh, there's another. Little tiny. Trying to get it in. There it is. The light on that painting, you could put on with a trowel. It is so heavy. This little subject over there is the detail from this. See that little figure kneeling just to the left of Christ? And you blow that up, and what you've got is expressionism. It's very, very contemporary. It is put on so heavily and pasty. But the whole thing, there is a candle in there somewhere, but the light is so bright that it diffuses the light source itself. This is the entombment. That's a little painting, again, only about a foot tall. Portrait. This is a Polish nobleman. Rembrandt was getting great commissions. He was very, very busy. And he was moving up the social ladder. He didn't, as I say, he didn't know how to handle it. He loved things. He just loved things. He collected paintings. He had a couple Raphaels in his own private collection. Great print collection. He collected jewelry, costumes, all kinds of stuff. He would go to the auctions and he would bid so outrageously on the first bid that nobody would counterbid him. Now, that's a guy who doesn't know how to handle money. But he had all of this stuff from Saskia's dowry, plus his own commissions, and he bought a great house, which is now a museum in Amsterdam. Some of you may have, I don't know if you got to Rembrandt's house, did you, John? It's a Rembrandt museum now, right on the canal. Fabulous place. Boy, at its time, it must have been the center of culture, and they had soirees and teas and all kinds of stuff. And Rembrandt went berserk with his money. Oh, I go berserk with Rembrandt. Some of this stuff is just amazing to me. This is a great story. And there is no commission for this kind of work. This is the dismissal of Hagar And I don't know how familiar you are with the story, but she was a bondswoman who gave birth to Abraham's first son, who was Ishmael. And Hagar's job was precisely that, to have a son by Abraham. But then Abraham's wife finally gave birth to her son, Isaac, you know, ha-ha. And everything was ha-ha for Sarah and Abraham, but it was pretty miserable for Ishmael and Hagar, who were sent away because Abraham could not have these two women in his house. And there is Abraham in the background doing his duty and putting Hagar onto the beast, onto the donkey. Ishmael does not know what's going on. He's just taking care of the donkey and ready to lead it out into the wilderness. And this painting I love particularly because that light that Hagar is made out of is totally unexplainable. There is nothing realistic at all about Hagar's light. It goes all the way around her. She is a column of light, and there is only one explanation for it. It is Rembrandt's love for her. Rembrandt loved Hagar so much that he had to depict her in this wonderful light. She had done her duty and is now sent out into the wilderness. This is a very moving, touching painting, but it also is an illustration of how painters can celebrate and how painters can make love, actually, with their paint. He did landscapes. He did quite a few of them. We'll see one later on. But they all seem to be kind of lowland landscapes, not high-blown, great constable landscapes with cathedrals and great cities, but just the land, just the country. And here's the one you wait for. Although it certainly isn't, in my thinking, the finest of Rembrandt's paintings. What's the name of this painting? Night Watch? No. The name of this painting is The Company of Captain Franz Banning Kok and Lieutenant Willem van Reutenberg, which is why we call it the Night Watch. That's like the name of one great artist is Domenico Theatocopoli, which is why we call him El Greco. You know, there's only so many things you can remember. But it's important to know what the original name of the painting is, because it is a fraternity painting again. This is a bunch of guys. They are harquebusiers. They are shooters. They are the National Guard. And they all have chipped in equal amounts to have their portrait painted in a group. And Rembrandt is painting their portrait. The only problem is that there are only 18 guys in this company, and he's painted a group portrait with 32 people in it. Which means these guys have also paid for other people to have their portraits painted, and that ain't fair. Not only that, but some of these guys got their portrait, who were paying for it, got their portraits painted in the shadows. And other guys, you know, it's like rank has its privilege. So the captain and the lieutenant got their portraits right up front. But the other guys got their portraits, some of them are way back in the shadows, and they're almost non-existent. Not only that, but there are some weird people in this painting who got no business being in this painting. Like this little lady here in gold. I don't know if I can bring her into focus. She is a lady in a costume as though she's ready to go to a ball somewhere. And she's got a dead chicken tied around her waist. Now, Rembrandt is just absolutely asking for trouble. And this particular year, the year in which he did the Night Watch, 1642, is the year that marks Rembrandt's decline, not in his painting, but in his life. Everything came unglued from 1642 on. And this painting has been analyzed as being the reason for that decline. Look at a couple details over there to see all of these people. Look at that group portrait. All kinds of stuff going on in there. Magnificent things. As we look close, look at how the paint is put on. It's not slick at all. It's painted very, very pastily, sometimes with a painting knife, not just a brush. Look at the light bouncing off of the front of that guy's chest. The great shadows. All kinds of things happening inside of this painting. And one of the great things is texture. Very smooth. Sometimes you can see the canvas. It's so raw. And other things, times the painting is so thick that it's on the verge of being sculpture. Let's move in on this outfit. Look at his hand holding that spear. That paint is really put on very, very heavily. So what Rembrandt is talking to us now about is not this group of people. He's talking to us about painting. Well, this got him in trouble. And in addition, Saskia, his wife, died the same year. The same year. People got upset because Rembrandt started playing around with symbolism, and Dutch folks don't want symbolism. They want straight out history and memorabilia. Just tell it like it is, Rembrandt. Don't doll it up. And pretty soon, all of his patrons left him, and he was free to start painting the things that he wanted to do. And they tell us so much more about Rembrandt now than they do about Holland, that it's a little bit spooky. You can see the man turning inside of himself. I show you this painting on the right. It's not a really great painting, but it is significant because it shows Rembrandt and his new concerns. Things are getting very loose. Now you compare this Nativity and the Holy Family with this by Rubens. This is what Catholic Holland is about. That kind of painting. Robust. I don't know how old that kid is, but I imagine the Virgin Mary must have had a terrible time giving birth to that kid. I mean, he must have been 24 pounds when he was born. He really should be made out of plaster and hung from a ceiling and swung around like a putti, blowing trumpets up there in the air. His arm is bigger than my leg. Fat, robust, healthy, and very, very typical realism. It's pure realism. But in Rembrandt, he is trying to say more than just simply visual reality. He's trying to say something about humbleness. This Holy Family is not humble. They are not of lowly consequence. These people are. You can't tell hardly the difference between the shepherds and the Holy Family here. They're all together, and they are wrapped not in natural light, but in heavenly light. This little painting is one of the most remarkable and least known of all of Rembrandt's. That is Christ at the Column. And that may be a surprise to you. I don't think you're familiar with it at all, and I think it's one of the most important paintings Rembrandt ever did. This is Jesus at the Column, the Column being the place where he was flogged, beaten, before he carried the cross to the site of his death. So here is a figure about to accept his own execution. It's just simply an accepting posture. You don't have the historical evidence. You don't have people flailing away at this body. You have none of that. You have just a figure bathed in this marvelous light from head to foot in the process of accepting. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. It's that kind of a portrait. It's an amazing thing. And I think it marks a kind of a self-portrait of Rembrandt himself. I think this is literally how Rembrandt felt at this particular time. A little Dutch girl in her early 20s moved into Rembrandt's house to tidy up the place. Hendrika. She and Rembrandt were very dear friends. Eventually, she gave birth to Rembrandt, to a child from Rembrandt, but they never married. And they never married because if Rembrandt remarried, he would have lost what remained of Saskia's dowry, which was willed to him in her will. Rembrandt couldn't afford to lose it. It was all he had. And Hendrika understood. The church kept badgering Hendrika to leave Rembrandt's house, but she loved him. And they had to move into a poorer quarters, and the neighbors didn't seem to mind that they were living together. And this is a portrait, really, of Hendrika as Suzanne, Susanna and the Elders. The mill, which Constable considered, the Constable was a great British landscape artist. He considered this to be one of the five greatest landscape paintings ever done. Simple, powerful, it's almost like an icon. This is for Rembrandt what those shoes were for Van Gogh. Do you remember Van Gogh's little golden shoes? This is one of my paintings to laugh at. I love this painting, but it's funny. A 70-year-old guy with a 45-pound piece of metal on his head, who does he represent? Well, I think he represents an old soldier, just an old soldier, living out his life. He can barely, his neck is going to get corrugated carrying that hunk of metal. That the metal is so thick that it's actually a piece of sculpture. The helmet is painted so thickly that it is dimensional. You can rub your fingers, oh, you better not. They'll come and cart you away. But you can. The light is built up so thickly. And yet there are places in the face itself where you can see the raw canvas. And we are really looking at a soul. A man involved with his memories who has really no right to carry that burden anymore. Oh. Rembrandt's really getting it down with the poor folk, with the working people. That's a portrait of him. He's still got a few possessions at this time. But boy, behind his eyes, you talk about reading the bridge of people's noses. Look at that bridge, folks. This man is in big trouble. He is not high and mighty. He's not angry anymore. He is in many ways a beaten man. I throw these Rubens things on just for contrast, just to show you what is going on at exactly the same time. Rubens was probably the most popular artist in his own lifetime who ever lived. He had commissions. He could hardly keep. He had a stable of artists that would finish his paintings. He'd just start them and everybody else would finish them. He had a great, great house with all just tremendously wealthy. And look what the kind of stuff he was painting. This is definitely Roman Catholic. cheery, smiley, elegant, high class, high blown, and Rembrandt was painting little servant girls. Hendrika is not in very good shape either. This is a portrait of her as Bathsheba. And there's that another view of this marvelous little girl. She is so beautiful. Rembrandt has got her thinking about the drudgery of her life, about her own worth, what she is worth as a person who sweeps floors all day long. She can't be more than 15. I bet you she's closer to 10 or 11. But she sees ahead of her a whole life of dirty floors. And Rembrandt not only sympathizes, but he celebrates her. There's no tragedy here. He's really glorified her. Now look at this. This is Rembrandt's descent from the cross. Look at a couple of things, like the face of Joseph of Arimathea looking right smack into the eye of Jesus. This weight coming down, just kind of sagging, dead. It is God dead, sliding down off of the cross. People looking at one another, interreaction of emotion and feeling because of the event itself, not because of anything really that went before or no expectations to follow after. I mean, from this point on, they are all going into an upper room and they are going to hide out, and Mary is going to grieve for her dead son, and yet there is this light in the middle of all of it that says, this is glory. The death of God is glory. Now you look at Rubens and his painting of exactly the same thing. It is robust. The light is bouncing off of the objects. It's not coming from within. There is very little interpersonal relationship in this Rubens painting. The weight of the body has no impact whatsoever on the fabric that is holding it up. What Rubens is looking forward to in this painting is the resurrection. If there is one word that will describe Baroque Roman Catholic painting, it is ecstasy. That painting is about ecstasy. This painting is about the death of God. Although they are almost identically the same, this is Roman Catholic and this is Protestant. You can actually visualize denominational and theological distinctions, and I can't think of a better example of how that might be done than in these two paintings. You could write books about the comparison between these two. His son Titus, who we painted 6 portraits of. Whoa. There's another painting of Titus. Eventually, Rembrandt's financial situation got so bad that Titus and Hendrika had to take over. They formed a little corporation, and they never gave Rembrandt enough except a little allowance to spend during the day. And Rembrandt painted for Hendrika. She commissioned him to do paintings, and Titus kept the books. Can you imagine? A servant girl moves into the house, bears him a child, and she becomes his keeper. Fantastic. Things are just coming unglued. Titus as a little monk. Hendrika over here. This painting of Hendrika in bathing in the river. It's an unusual painting for Rembrandt. It's genre, again, just a scene from everyday life. It doesn't represent Bathsheba or Susanna or any of the saints or any of the goddesses. It's just his wife taking a bath in a river. And it is a beautiful, monumental painting. He loved her very much. Oh, Rembrandt. There is just not much. Not much even in the way of commissions. It's amazing how at the end of his life he starts painting more and more portraits of himself. It's almost like Van Gogh, who paints tables and chairs and sunflowers because nobody has come to call. This is the Aristotle contemplating the bust of Homer, which I think is a very funny painting also. Because if you would actually look, the live person is abstract and the bust is of a live person. I mean, that bust is actually looking up at Aristotle and carrying on a conversation with him. That's spooky because he's got no arms, chest, legs, or anything else. He's just neck, a little bit of chest, and a head. It's like a, you know, it's like one of these horror films. It's the living brain. It's alive. The two are just going at it, carrying on a conversation, except the live person is only a mask of light around his eyes. Look at that. Look how dark and deep Rembrandt's paintings are going. Yet he's still able to keep them alive. Hendrika, who was busy trying to manage Rembrandt's affairs, and Rembrandt says, "Would you hold it in the doorway a minute, Hendrika, while I paint your portrait?" What a klutz.
Is there any detail in that black at all?
None. There is an awful lot of detail in the dark areas of Rembrandt, which is why we shouldn't look at slides. We should go to the Rijksmuseum and look at the real thing. Because there's an awful lot of liveliness going on in dark passages, but toward the end, in this painting particularly, there's very little. Look at that end portrait. Look at here. In this painting, Rembrandt is more Cézanne than Cézanne. And it's from this painting that an awful lot of people say Rembrandt is the father of modern painting, because he has built that old prophet's head out of stucco and stone like he would build a building. He got a few commissions toward the end. In fact, Cosimo de' Medici III came to visit him. He was internationally known, but he was a recluse. Oh, I love these last portraits. And probably one of my most, I don't know, it's like Brahms. What's your favorite Brahms? My favorite Brahms is the one I happen to be listening to at the time. I guess my favorite Rembrandt is the one I happen to be looking at the moment. But I don't know of another Rembrandt that I like any more than The Jewish Bride. It's unfinished. A wedding portrait. And it is so tender, so gentle and loving. Very thinly painted with just almost pure light reflections off of a few little details of costume. But none of that interrupts this kind of loving relationship that goes on between them. Look at that. It's almost like that one arm has two hands coming off of it. They are so together one in this painting. That is just a remarkable thing. A couple last portraits. A head of Christ. Look at that self-portrait. Now you know what I mean about the whole world between the eyes, the bridge of the nose. Rembrandt sees his whole life now great success. He was a prodigal son. He went to the flesh pots with all of Saskia's dowry. He has finally come home, and his last painting, now this was a very late portrait, but his last painting is this one, The Prodigal Son. Very loosely painted, beautiful in its color. We don't think of Rembrandt as a colorist. Lovely color. Dark and light. The profligate has eaten with the pigs. His son Titus has just died. There is no one to manage even the day-by-day chores, which Rembrandt just does not know how to take care of. And he dies as he paints a kind of prayer, The Prodigal Son. Everything was for Rembrandt a mystery. Everything was for Rembrandt an attempt to relate his life, rich or poor, to what God had in mind for him and for us all. Thank you very much.